The Saturday panel on OTB.
We're talking about these lighter footballs, you're right, but it's with the pace which they come through. And it would literally be a case where I would do sessions ahead in 20, 30 balls where I would be literally feeling dizzy after it. So now to hear these type of statistics and the research that's gone into it, of course, it's a major worry.
Don't miss the panel every Saturday afternoon on OTB Sports Radio. Tune in 24/7 on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Podcast Network.
All right, you're welcome along to the latest of the OTB Sports Remote Roadshows in association with Cadbury FC. Check out cadburyfc.com for updates on promotions and giveaways. We have spoken to some legends of the game in recent weeks, and we have two more big names for you today. Jason McAteer is with us. Hiya, Jason.
How are you, Nath? You okay?
I'm all right. And we have a man who needs no introduction, but I'm going to give him the big introduction anyways, because we are delighted to be joined by a man who, when he started out at Celtic, won four titles and four Scottish Cups. His move to Liverpool sparked an unprecedented run of success for the club as a player, six league titles and three European Cups. As manager, three league titles, a couple of FA Cups, throw in another league title with Blackburn, and you really do have one of the greats of the game. When your nickname is the King, you know you're doing all right. Kenny Dalglish, thanks for joining us.
Not a problem. I think you've been drinking, Nathan.
You're keeping well?
Trying my best. If you don't visit the doctor, you know that you're okay.
Exactly. You could have had a closer relationship from a much earlier time, I guess, Kenny, because you tried to sign Jason McAteer at one stage.
But I learned my lesson after that. No, we did. We tried to sign from Bolton, Jason, and also Alan Stubbs. But Bolton weren't in agreement of selling the two of them. And our guy was, specific that he had to have two. So that was it. That was two or none. And we ended up with none.
Jason.
Yeah.
You turned down the King. How could you do that?
I know. It was really difficult, Nate, at the time, because obviously I was still fairly new to football. I'd only signed pro 3 years previous, and we'd had a great run with Bolton Cup games, and like the gaffer was saying, me and Alan Stubbs were making names for ourselves. We were a good age. A lot of clubs were coming down to watch. And Liverpool, obviously, as you know, Kenny was my hero growing up, and I always wanted to aspire to do what he did and follow in his footsteps and play for Liverpool. So, obviously, you know, he was manager at Blackburn at the time, but, you know, I was a Liverpool fan. So I was always sort of looking to see if Liverpool were watching us play at Bolton, and Ron Yates was coming down and Roy Evans. So I knew they were watching closely. And then, I mean, as any footballer will tell you, transfers, they come out the blue. You think it's going to happen today, and it doesn't. And 2 weeks go by, and then it just happens. And we were driving into work, and I got a phone call from my agent at the time saying Blackburn had agreed £9 million for myself and Alan Stubbs. Obviously, Blackburn were paying £8.5 million for me and £500,000 for Stubbsy. So we turned the car around, went straight up the motorway, and went in to meet Kenny. And I was first in, and I got to be honest, I was starstruck. I walked in, and he was with Ray Harford, and we went into a room that he'd hired there, and we sat down, and halfway through the meeting, my agent took a phone call and come back in and said, Liverpool have agreed £4.5 million for Jason. They don't want Stubbsy. And then Kenny just kind of told us what he said there. He said, it's two or none. So I had a word with Alan, and you know, he said, listen, it's fine. If you want to sign for Liverpool, sign for Liverpool. So I went up. Kenny was gracious and let me go up and speak to Liverpool. He said, just give me an answer tonight. So out of courtesy, I rang him back. And I don't think he was too happy, to be honest. And I was gutted. I had to turn him down. But my heart was always at Liverpool.
Are you good at hiding your frustration in those circumstances, Kenny?
He wasn't.
Oh, by the way, I would have signed for Liverpool as well if I'd have been in Jason's position. There's no problem. It wasn't the first time it happened. Or it wouldn't be the last either. It wouldn't have been the last, so... No, listen, if you get an opportunity to sign for any really big clubs, you're going to take it. And if you don't take it, then you yourself need a wee bit of an examination. If they're in for you and you're happy to go, then fine. And obviously Jason was a Liverpool fan, and that makes it worse.
I never really looked at the time. Who did you go and buy?
I don't know.
Can you remember?
No? I don't know. Well, in your position, there was
Tim.
Tim Sherwood came in $500,000 or something. Maybe it was and then who else did we sign? Paul Warhurst played there. Centre backs. We signed. No, I don't know what year it was, Jason.
This was, I think, 90, it was the summer you had just won the title, just after you'd won the title at Blackburn.
Just after we'd won it.
Mm.
Yeah.
You said, Kenny, you said, look, that's football. It's not the first time. It's not the last time that this happened. You must have been a little bit sick of the Irish players, though, by this stage, because obviously it had happened quite memorably with Roy Keane as well, where on a Friday, is it on a Friday night you thought the deal was done, and on a Monday morning he's a Manchester United player?
I don't remember the days. But we thought Roy was going to come. We had two or three meetings with him. Everything seemed okay. But as I said earlier, when a Manchester United or a Liverpool come in, you can't blame the players for wanting to go or deciding to go. I would have done the same thing.
Mm.
So they can't be wrong if I'm going to be right, what my judgment would be. But as I say, it was unfortunate for us, but that was their decision. And to this day, you wouldn't argue with them.
No. Great players will obviously always be able to play with each other. If Roy had arrived that time at Blackburn and he's gone into a side with Alan Shearer, how do you think that dynamic would have worked in the dressing room of leadership? You're talking about two of the greatest players, two of the strongest minds, two real alpha males in that Blackburn dressing room. I'm sure it's what you wanted. How do you think they would have worked together?
I don't think there'd be no problem. Football's football, isn't it? It's not the first time a dressing room would have had two strong alpha males, as you described them, in the dressing room. And there's never been a team that's been successful without them. So as long as any disagreement isn't carried onto the pitch, then I don't see a problem. Not everybody that plays together in a team gets on or likes or appreciates somebody else as a person. As long as you appreciate them on the pitch, that's the most important thing. And if you start carrying grudges on the pitch, then the manager's got a decision to make. There's one of them got to go. Mm. And that's just the way I looked at it. So for Roy Keane and Alan Shearer to be together would have been a fantastic duet. But the person we had in there, Tim Sherwood, who was the skipper, he wasn't too bad either.
No.
So the reason you go for players is to strengthen your squad, not because you're embarrassed with some of the players that you have. So we were in no way, shape or form unhappy with the players. We just thought we had to move up, onwards and upwards. And unfortunately, there's one person going to be suffering when a new player comes in, and that's the one that's hurt. But generally, for the rest of the players, it's a benefit to them to bring in the better players, and they want to play with the highest quality players that they possibly can.
To be honest, Nate, I think back then leadership is different than what it is now. You know, we see players leading by example this day and age. It was different back in the 90s. You know, there was a lot of, as you mentioned, alpha males. You know, there was a lot of strong characters around. You know, a lot of big players. Tim Sherwood was a leader in his own way. Colin Hendry, you know, Roy, Patrick Vieira, you know, Neil Ruddock in our team, John Barnes, Mark Wright. You know, so it was just the way it was. And you actually get on. It doesn't matter, you know, if you clash. If you clash, you clash. But like Kenny said, if it's for the better of the team on a Saturday or a Wednesday and you're winning games, then you put up with it. It's only when it filters out into the dressing room and you're fighting and all that, then the manager's got to make a decision. And that did happen quite a lot. So, yeah, it was just different back then.
Mm. Roy's decision to go to United, and he goes and links up with Alex Ferguson. And throughout your, half century at this stage in football, Kenny, yourself and Alex Ferguson have either butted heads, got along brilliantly, but you've both been alongside each other along most steps of the road. When you go back to when you were a teenager and when you first met, what was your first impression of Ferguson?
Well, we've never butted heads. So you can take that one
right
away. Fergie, Fergie went to Rangers. I was about 18, 19, and I was at Celtic. And Jock Steen, who obviously was a manager, he took a great interest in the kids. And he used to move us about in various positions just so you could get an education of what to expect from the guy that was playing in the position you didn't even want to play in. When you went back to your own position, you had a better understanding of what would help him. So I was in that category when I was 18 and played against Fergie a year after he'd signed for Rangers in the reserve game at Celtic Park. And I was centre-back. Big fella at the back here, winning a few headers. I don't think I ever got off the floor. We beat him 2-0. And I think he's still got to come out my pocket every now and again for a bit of air. But I never had a problem with Fergie. He stood his corner for his club. I stood the corner for my club. Fergie and I go back long before anybody here had ever heard of myself or Fergie. When he was in Glasgow, there just seemed to be the thing for footballers or managers to buy a pub when you're in Scotland. So he bought a pub. My father-in-law was in the publican's business, and he taught Fergie the license trade.
Right.
So he goes back long before the football, or before they knew about him down here. And he's always been somebody you could talk to, approach. But I don't think there's anything wrong with having an argument. If he thinks he's right, he's going to argue he's right.
Yeah.
And I'm going to argue that I'm right. And I'm going to stand up for my club. And you would expect Fergie to stand up for his. I think you'd be failing in your duties and your responsibilities if you never.
What was life growing up for you and Fergie in Scotland? Were you, as kids, were you always out in the streets playing football? Or, you know, was that the only thing you kind of did as kids up there, like we did down in Liverpool?
Well, I was brought up in the north side of the city and Fergie was brought up in the south side. I don't know what like it was for him, but for me, it was exactly what you said. It went in the sporting calendar, depending what was on in the sporting calendar. If it was golf and somebody had a golf club and a ball, you'd be up in the playing fields with the empty Heinz tomato soup can in the ground with some stones. That was a hole, and another one a good bit away. And when it was athletics on, we'd be racing around the block. Tennis, we'd go down to the public park and on the tennis court and hit a tennis ball. Might as well have been a golf ball.
Probably was a golf ball.
And then if there happened to be a match on the telly, there wasn't much of, you'd be out at half-time with your mates and have a wee game during half-time on the street. There wasn't as many cars or anything then. And the only time we stopped playing in the street was when the ice cream van came round. So that was just a normal upbringing. And I don't know what Fergie did. He came, as I say, he was born and bred in roundabout shipyard country.
I want to know about the tennis racket, because that must have been a posh kid, that, having a tennis racket.
Obviously, you've never been there. You rent them.
Do you ever take them back?
It was worse if you lost a ball. If you lost a tennis ball, you had to pay for it. We never had any money.
You nicked
somebody else's.
It must have been incredible, Kenny, coming through then and signing with Celtic so soon after the Lisbon Lions, and Jock Steen is there and you're having those sort of conversations where you're playing in a reserve game and he's figured out how he wants to teach his attacking players by playing in a different position. You're in and around the likes of Billy McNeil, Jinky Johnston. Were you somebody who, as a teenager, when you're in there, you realise just how special an opportunity it is?
No, I think you'll never be unappreciative of the opportunity that you get. And for me, when I was 15, I came to Liverpool for a trial, and then I was invited in for a couple of weeks. Played another game, and Shanks and Ruben Bennett gave us a lift back to the YM in Mount Pleasant and said, "We'd love to sign you." And I said, "Well, send the scout up to see my mum and dad in Glasgow." I was going home. And then it was a bit far for a 15-year-old to travel every week. So I stayed up in Glasgow and played for an amateur side that was brilliant. And we played Celtic's kids in a game and we beat them. I scored one of the goals. And Jock Steen said to the guy that ran our club, he said, we'd like to sign him, but we understand that he's gone to Rangers. And he said, well, he doesn't understand that. So a couple of days later, the assistant manager, Sean Farland, was up at the house, asked me if I'd like to sign. And I looked at my dad and he said, yep. And that was it. That was me, 16 years of age at Celtic Park. Did a couple of nights a week. And then they sent us out to a semi-professional team when we were 16, just to toughen us up a wee bit. Poof. Just a touch. But it was brilliant for us. All the young boys then, I mean, you'll have heard of Daddy McGrain. Well, we went up at the same time, joined together and signed. First day's training, full time. He was a year older than me. But we used to meet up in the middle of town, jump in the bus, go to the ground. And even travelling in the bus, you were nervous. And that was us only going to pre-season training.
Right.
So, no, it was... And he was also out with another club for a year. So there was a load of us went out on loan. Lou McCarry went out on loan. Another lad that you wouldn't know, but they would know in Scotland. So it was very worthwhile, and it was a great education. And by the way, if you'd have picked a club to go to, you couldn't have picked a better one than Celtic. Because of the success they had, the European champions in 67. And that was, we were getting up for training just after that. We were starting to train full time. Big Jock had a great deal of time for the young boys in the reserves, and they used to come and help and do a wee bit coaching or give you a bit of tuition. And it was a brilliant time for us. And you couldn't have picked a better spot. And I don't think it was a coincidence that it was four or five of their lads went on to be professional footballers at a good level.
What position were you?
I think I started as a midfield dynamo.
Right? I know.
Big Job moved me back to educate me into centre back. Then I went back up. I went up front then. Scored a few goals and got in the first team as a striker for the start of the season when I was 18. And then when I was about 20, I came back into the team, but it was more sort of an offensive midfield player. I didn't care who I offended. I was just offensive.
I always assumed, I don't know why, Kenny, just, I suppose, because of the incredible of your career that you had, that you were this typical wonder kid who sort of burst through at 17, got his place in the first team at 17 and never left. But what you talk about there, you come in at 18, it's a slow enough process. You're into your early 20s before you're firmly established in that Celtic 11. Was that just the way it was then, that this was men's football, as you say, it was tough, tough football, that there were very few players making it at a very young age?
You don't see too many 17-year-olds knocking out a European Cup winner for his position, do you?
No, that's for sure.
In the first team. So I don't think that was an option.
So were you always comfortable with that? Were you always comfortable with being impatient?
I came on sub when I was 17 for one of the games. It was a League Cup tie, second leg. 10-0 the first leg, and it was 4-0 half-time. And Big Jock said, go on, you're going on. I thought, you're taking a bit of a chance here.
Yeah.
No, it was an education for us.
Yeah.
And when I was 18, I played four first-team games. So there was progress, but although it was slow, you were being educated all the time.
Yeah, it does seem like such an incredible period to be part of the club with so many legends of the game. There's the nine in a row, which obviously is very topical. Once again, touch briefly on the nine in a row and the lack of the 10 in a row. If you could pinpoint it, what happened and what went wrong, and you could give any lessons to this current Celtic side of trying to complete a 10 in a row, what would it be?
I couldn't give them any lessons. It wasn't such a big thing. for us right. then. And I think there was a game when we were growing up when they played Clyde. I think they might have, I think it was 8 in a row where they all wore number 8 shorts to signify that they'd won the league. I don't know if I was playing in that or not, but the 9 in a row was, it was just another trophy, wasn't it? It was a milestone, but it was another trophy. You won the league. That was the most important thing. Right. And it was either, not, it was maybe us and Rangers, obviously. Aberdeen starting to sniff about a wee bit then as well. But we suffered a couple of drubbings as well. We beat 4-1 in a League Cup final with Partick Thistle. And we couldn't win the League Cup for love nor money. And every time I scored, we get beat in the final. Scored against Thistle, we get beat 4-1. Scored against Rangers, we get beat 3-2 in the Scottish Cup final. So I thought, oh, if I'm in front of goal, I'm going to pass it to somebody else.
Knocked that on the head, scoring.
Oh, no. Just give me the medal. Give me the medal. And then just the season that I left, it was we won the league. And then we beat Rangers in the final 1-0. So
you talked about being, you know, in that dressing room with European Cup winners as such a young lad. How difficult was it? Because as we know, dressing rooms can be a very harsh place.
We weren't in the dressing room, we were next door. We were in the Resi's dressing room as usual.
Okay.
But I'll tell you, to a man, the Lisbon Lions were brilliant. They were really humble. You played a game and there wasn't that many people in full time anyway to get a team with injuries and everything else. But when you played in the games or you played small-sided games, all they did was encourage you. They were fantastic, honest, that way. And it was, they were closer to the younger players then. Mm. And I think that helped us as well. You know, the fact that they were there. Obviously, you were respectful, you were annoyed them, but they gave you respect as well in a strange way. We know they try to encourage you and you'd make a mistake and that'd be helpful criticism you would get probably. So, no, I think that the two things, Big Jock and the attitude of the people who were so successful at the football club, being able to spend time with the younger players, it helped us enormously. It must have.
Mm. I was watching back over the last few days quite a few games of that Celtic era. You'll find them on YouTube, Kenny, if you ever want to go back and be a little bit nostalgic. The one...
Listen, we've been in lockdown since...
You've watched them all.
I've seen it twice.
The one that stands out is the Atletico Madrid European Cup semi-final, 74, 0-0 draw at Celtic Park. That goes down as one of, I think, certainly the dirtiest game in Celtic's history. There's... what, 8 Atletico Madrid players left? Their manager is Juan Carlos Lorenzo. He was the Argentina manager in 66 when Alf Ramsey described Argentina as animals. Was that the dirtiest game of football you've ever been involved in?
I wouldn't think so. I think when you were growing up and playing in parks, I think you got a few games there as well that would rival that. And he had two teams. He had a team for home and a team for away. And the team... obviously, they played at Celtic Park. I think they're assassins, so they get 3 sent off. If there'd been another 1 sent off, we'd have been awarded the game 2-0. And that'd have been my best chance of scoring, probably. But we, as I say, 0-0, you're going over there, semi-final. I think we could beat 2-0.
Mm. Yeah, 2-0 in the semi-final.
All right. So we got close against Milan as well. And we get beaten penalties in the semi-final. But to play against them and the way they went about it, that was an education as well. The fact he kicked you, didn't it? That wasn't a problem, was it? I mean, you were strong enough then to know what was going to happen. And if you were stupid enough, you would probably retaliated. But there was a wee bit of a skirmish coming off after the game. But then, as I say, over there, totally different side of it, and they beat us 2-0.
Yeah, you got to watch this back, Jason, because there's, what, an hour gone? I think 10 Atletico Madrid players have already been booked. There's one stage where Jinky Johnston is cutting in from the left-hand side. One of the players has 3 kicks at him, and he still manages to weave his way through all the tackles. And then another guy comes in and just poleaxes him completely. I think that was the first red card. It was. I know it's a learning experience. Is it for a incredibly skillful, technically skillful player like you? Were they frustrating games to play in? In any way, or did you just accept it?
It's on to me there, Nate.
Yeah, it's frustrating because they're out to stop football, aren't they? Mm. And it's frustrating to see somebody like me, Jimmy, who was fantastic. And by the way, brave as a lion. He wouldn't mind getting kicked. Might have hurt him a little bit, but he wouldn't mind. He'd go back and confront you again. Mm. He was fantastic, wee Jimmy. A great player. That was their culture. That was the Argentinians' culture. You saw it against England. Rattan gets sent off, the captain, in the World Cup, I think it was. And then they come up and play us. You wouldn't buy a season ticket for the Atletico Madrid games in that era anyway.
No.
But fair dues to them. I think they got beat in the final 4-0, didn't they?
Yeah. So they got their comeuppance eventually.
They were winning. They were winning, by the way. Somebody scored a last-minute equaliser. Was it Bayern Munich?
Yeah, it may well have been, yeah. 74.
The centre-back, the big German centre-back, number 4, smacked one in for about 35 yards. And it went to a replay. It wasn't the extra time. I think it went to a replay. And they get beat 4-0. Deservedly.
The decision to go to Liverpool, like, you've had so much success at Celtic, and it's at a time where there's not quite the divide there is now in quality between Scottish football and English football. Was it still a straightforward decision when Liverpool come in as European champions to sign you?
It wasn't the fact they were European champions. It was the fact it was Liverpool. I'd been there, as I said, at 15. Mm. I'd watched there was a documentary on at the end of 76-77 season. Liverpool had won the league. They get beaten in the cup final to Man U, and they were going to play in the European Cup final. So I watched that and I thought, Jesus, it's no change very much for when I was there. Obviously, Bob was a manager now and Shanks had retired. So if I was going to go from Celtic, and I made my mind up that it's not a rehearsal, you only get one go at it, why don't you go and have a go somewhere else? And if you're rubbish, maybe somebody in Scotland would come and take you back. You don't know, but it was worthwhile taking the chance. And when I get the phone call from Celtic to say that there was somebody wanting to speak to me, I just hoped it was Liverpool. And it was. It was John Smith and the chairman and Bob Paisley come up. So for me, I couldn't have been happier at the choice of club.
You know, you said that you went down on a trial. Did they always stay in touch with you, like from then up until when you signed, or did they just cut all contact?
No, I just say that I was too young to come down. I went to West Ham as well, and it was the same thing. It was a wee bit far, but a year later I signed for Celtic, so there wasn't much time in between. I wouldn't say they kept in touch. They kept in touch until he signed for Celtic, probably.
Yeah.
But he'd speak to my dad, wouldn't he speak to me? So, Liverpool was the best choice I could have made.
How does a transfer like that happen back then, Kenny?
I don't know.
Is it just does Jock Steen ring? Does Bob Paisley ring Jock Steen, or are there agents involved?
I never saw one. I think it started because I know this wasn't the only reason, because Bob said if Kevin hadn't left, he would still have tried to sign me.
Right.
So Kevin had chosen to go. Leave the club after winning the European Cup and went to Hamburg. So obviously there was a vacant spot there in Bob's mind, and fortunately for me, he came and asked me if I'd like to join. But the two clubs would have spoken to each other. I never get tapped up or anything like that. I was sitting in the father-in-law's pub and I got a phone call his big joke. He said, "Do you want to pop up to the park?" I said, "We just played at Northumberland." I said, it's 12 o'clock at night. He went, "Yeah, there's somebody here. There's somebody here you might want to talk to." I said, "Okay." So went up to the ground. Old Bob was there and John Smith, and 5 minutes it was done.
Right.
I don't know how long it took them.
Yeah, for you it was straightforward.
Three, but for me, oh, I.
Yeah.
And picked up the next big joke, gave me a lift the next morning. Going to meet them at Moffat, and they took us down to Liverpool, medical signed. Saturday playing against Manchester United in the Charity Shield.
Yeah. It must help coming from a club of the size of Celtic as well, because the conversation, I'm sure, at the time was replacing Kevin Keegan, the pressure of replacing Keegan. But coming from Celtic, I presume that pressure was there every week anyways, that you were just going to another club where you had no choice but to deliver.
Yeah, but Kevin never played for Celtic.
Mm.
It was a wee bit different. But all you can be yourself. If you try and be someone else, you're going to fail.
Mm.
So if you're not good enough, you're not good enough, and you've just got to accept it. And now I went to be myself. Kevin was fantastic for Liverpool and did even better probably at Hamburg.
Yeah.
He won European Footballer of the Year and they won the European Cup. So for me, it wasn't my choice that Kevin left. It was Kevin's choice, so I can only just be myself.
Do you think he thought he made a mistake when you battered them 6-0 in the European Cup?
The Super Cup.
Super Cup. That was only your second game, was it?
Super Cup, yeah.
No, we played them in the first leg.
Right.
I think we made a draw in the first leg, I don't know. But 6-0 at Anfield. Terry Mack hat trick.
God. No, so when you...
Kevin was magnanimous as well. He's good as gold. Anytime you meet him, it's always a good conversation and a bit of a chuckle. So, no, he did what he thought was right, and that's all you can do. And he probably thought the same way as, or similarly what I thought, in leaving Celtic. It's no rehearsal. So for him, it wouldn't be a rehearsal either.
Mm.
I know he came from Scunthorpe to Liverpool. He was wanting to move on to maybe play abroad, and he did. He went to Hamburg and was really successful.
So paint the picture of moving down to Liverpool. Was it into digs? Or did you buy a house straight away? Or
no, we Holiday Inn.
Glamorous.
It was glamorous.
Was it? Because back then.
Marina's dad knew the innkeeper, Jack Ferguson, who was Scottish. So we had three rooms.
Was that called a suite back then?
Oh, I don't know. A bedroom for Marina and I, a sitting room, which had a Swede suite in it. It wasn't Swede when we finished. and Kelly and Paul in the next room. So when they cried during the night, we couldn't hear them. And by the way, absolutely looked after us royally. Just not necessarily with extravagant food or drink or anything. Just looked after us royally. The people were brilliant. The people were brilliant. And within 5 minutes, you felt really comfortable and part and parcel of the city of Liverpool. And that is really helpful. It was good. So that was us. We went in there and he said, when we were leaving, he said, "I'll need to get rent a kill in to clean that suite."
Brilliant.
The warm welcome obviously helped as well. You settled in really quickly. I think, is it the first three, four league games? You score in all of them. That dressing room you walk into at the time of, you mentioned Terry McDermott is there, Emlyn Hughes, Tommy Smith, Phil Neal. What's that Liverpool dressing room like around 1977? Is it different to Celtic, or is it a straightforward process that you settle in quite easily?
Well, we settled in very easily. Very similar to Celtic when you get in. You're made welcome. Jason will know about the dressing room culture. You've got to be strong. It's laughing and joking. And if you're the brunt of it, you either can take it or you can't take it, and you can survive or you don't survive. But it's only done to try and make you feel welcome, although it's a cruel way of making you feel welcome sometimes. And I never had to go through that. I was probably a wee bit old for them. at 26 that they maybe thought, no, he might not have a sense of humour. Mm. So I went in, and in fact, when I signed, Emlyn, bless him, came to see us on the Wednesday night when I was in the hotel just after I'd signed, just to make me feel welcome. So that was a good start for us. And then the rest of them, it was just a really friendly place, but strong, as I said earlier. A strong dressing room will get you success.
Mm. And success.
And they were strong, and they had success. And by the way, after the first day's training, I thought, this is endorsed what you thought. They're hungry for more success.
Right.
And I was desperate for a European medal.
Was it similar to Celtic, the dressing rooms? Were they very similar? Could you see similarities between?
It's strong. The thing had moved on for when Celtic were successful. There was more commercial aspect. The players were under, like, sponsors wanting to sign players up and one thing and another when we came down here. They never really... It wasn't even be there when the Lisbon Lions were going about the place, really.
Yeah.
And it crept in a wee bit when I was up there. And sometimes because of that, you get some jealousy because some... players are favoured more than others, but there was some animosity in the dressing room at Liverpool when you came, maybe because of that. But by the way, it never ever affected it on the pitch. Never anything that was done in the dressing room that was maybe somebody had a gripe about was carried onto the pitch, and I thought that was brilliant.
Mm.
And I couldn't believe when I walked into the dressing room. There was remember the old dressing room? You come through a door, then there was a wee door, and you went in. And inside on the wall was a full-length mirror. And over there was a full-length mirror with an electrical socket next to it. And I'm thinking myself, I'm in early, obviously, your first day, and I'm thinking, what's the socket doing there? Right? So then they come in with the hold-alls. I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, you must have to take your kit home as well. I've not even brought a bag. And it wasn't. It was the hairdryers. After training, they're all shampooed their hair and they're into the hairdryers and they're giving it that. And Terry Mack with his fork and his perm, and I'm going, oh, Jesus Christ. Well, I've never seen this before.
There's about 20 perms in that dressing room back then.
Oh, I know, aye. And they all had their fork. The combs were like that.
Yeah.
The fork. And they, oh. There was Tomo, Terry Mack.
Neely.
Neely had a go at one, aye. And then... I don't know. The two can't be natural. You can't have natural straight hair and then have curly hair. So he's either ironed his hair when it was curly, right? or something else. And the part of it was brilliant. The part of the dressing room was brilliant.
Who did you gravitate to when you were in there?
Big Jockey was there. He came in April.
Okay.
He came in April and I came down in August. And then Graham came in January when we got beat at Chelsea.
And did you know them? Did you know them before Liverpool?
Graham was at Celtic when he was 15, training a couple of nights a week.
Okay.
So I knew him for there. And Jockey, he played with Partick Thistle with his brother. So I didn't remember playing against them. So
no.
They must have battered them. but so the part was brilliant.
That's
he came in, he went in there as a wee boy, 19. And by the way, he ended up being the worst person in the dressing room to sit next to. He just wound him up. It was great, but great dressing.
Like a year like that where you arrive down, Graham Souness comes in, Alan Hansen comes in, sets out the next decade for Liverpool of success. And then you probably have similar around 87 when John Barnes, Peter Beardsley arrive in. A time like that, I don't know how much Bob Paisley could have orchestrated that those players all emerged at the same time, but do the players make the great team or do the great team that's already there make those players great? Or is it just a bit of both?
I think it's a bit of both. Obviously, when I went, when Big Al and I went, it was on the back of huge success that Liverpool had. the dressing room is set in his way, you just conform to what happens in the dressing room. The same for when Graham came in. That was still in its way. It's only January, but we've been beating 4-1, I think, or 4-2 at Chelsea in the cup. Then they signed Graham to take Cali's place. The dressing room for me was always an integral part of the football club. And we kept adding to it because it was successful. You could bring in one or two players. It wasn't like when John and Wee Peter, Aldo came in first in the January for that team. And then Ray Houghton was the last one in October. Then what was that, 86, 87
season?
Yeah.
Right? So before that, the first season, obviously, we had a good season. The second year, we won nothing. So we had to change a wee bit, and the people upstairs had come to me no long into the new year and said, we've got some money if you want to buy some players. I said, well, it would be helpful. So either that or I'm getting the sack.
Yeah.
To be fair, I gave them a list of players and there was 5 names on it and they got 4 of them. So it wasn't a bad chance. And it just shows you the support that you had from upstairs.
Yeah, it certainly does. Just on Souness, because John Giles, who you would have played against, I'm sure, through the years, is on with us all the time and off the ball, and he always refers to Souness as the midfielder of that generation. Even now when he's looking at midfielders, Souness is the one he goes back to compare to. When he arrived in that January from Chelsea to the player he became 4 or 5 years ago, was he the finished article when he arrived at Liverpool?
No, I don't think anybody is. I think when are you ever the finished article? There's always something you can add to it a wee bit. He'd been at Tottenham, left Tottenham, went to Middlesbrough, did really well at Middlesbrough, and we signed him. And he was brilliant for us. I think he scored in his debut against Man U, left foot volley, and that was him up and running. But Graham was a wee bit different to what the rest of the dressing room was. He was like a... He would have the face cream and the hair cream, and the boys were a bit rougher than that. Although they had perms, they never bothered with that or the other stuff. Or they had used the odour, obviously. You know what he smelled, but he was, and they had the BMW, the two-door BMW. But he was good as gold. He had a strut, but amongst the lads and in the dressing room, he didn't think it was big time.
Right.
He just thought, what a club this is, I've come to. Brilliant. And he moved into the Holiday Inn when I was there. So we had a few laughs in there.
Right. It worked for him though, didn't it? Like, look at him now. Look how well he looks. All that moisturiser worked out well.
By the way, you can't beat a good surgeon's knife, can you?
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. If he goes near a radiator, he's going to melt. He just needs to stay away from anything else. Kenny, I just want to ask you, I was probably around 10 or 11, could never get a ticket for Liverpool for love and the money, but my uncle had a couple of season tickets and I managed to go to, my first game was main stand, lower, Manchester City, and instantly I walked in first game and for some reason you just knew you were the fans' favourite and you instantly become my favourite. I think you hit the bar that game as well. You twisted someone on the byline and bent one in and hit the bar. And but what do you think it is with the Liverpool fans that makes you a favourite? Like what is it you think that you had more than anyone else? Was it charisma or the cheekiness, or could they relate to you because of Scotland and the way you were brought up? What do you think it was?
I've not got a clue. As I said earlier, I only came down here to do what Kenny Dalglish could do. No trying to emulate what Kevin had done or anything else.
Yeah.
And I was just myself. And for me, the greater picture for me, it's great to get an individual award. It's even greater to get a team award. And I just like to collect winners' medals and trophies. And I was never about myself. If somebody else was in a better position and I saw them, they could have it. I wasn't worried about whether I scored or whether I never scored. I was only worrying about the team as a whole winning. Whether they reflected that, I don't know. But I think I came down and I got off to a really good start. It wasn't 4 goals, Nath, it was 6. But we'll not worry about that, the first 6 games. I think but I don't know why. I don't know why they get an affection for anybody.
Yeah.
Everybody in the club, somebody has an affection for. And every single person in the club, since I've been there, has always given their lot. So, all right, if it's not good enough, you hold your hands up and say that at least I tried. But as long as you try, they're going to love you. I mean, the biggest cheer Andy Robertson's got is when he closed about 4 players down.
Yeah.
About a 200-yard run.
Remember? Right?
And that was it. And then they started Andy Robertson. How does he feel when they do that? Jesus, he just rose in stature, didn't he? For himself, he gave him huge belief. And the Liverpool fans are clever. I think they understand that. And they also understand that it's a bit difficult when you give them stick and then ask them to perform. So I think they recognise when somebody's having a go and they support that. And that's, as I say, together you can make a good team. Individually, you're not going to make anything.
That moment you described for Andy Robertson, that moment for you was probably the goal in the European Cup final in 78 when people talk about the noise at Anfield South, Wembley, and so many Liverpool supporters there, that even Liverpool supporters at Anfield who've been there for the great day said they've never felt noise like it when you scored that goal, that is the moment that you become King Kenny. Can you describe what it's like in that moment? Have you got the words to describe what it feels like to have that affection from those supporters on the biggest occasion? I'm sure, I don't know if it's something you think about, but like it's something very few people in their lives get to experience.
No, as I say, you just do your work and try and do it as best you possibly can. I think the most important thing is if the fans are on your side, that you don't get carried away. They're on your side because of what you've done and what you had achieved. So they're not going to... There you are, look, she's pulling a blanket over it.
She's sick of listening to
that. That wasn't the gaffer.
Is she not on furlough? No.
No, but it's you get carried away with what they're doing. You try to think you're bigger or better than what you are.
Mm.
No, they like you for what the way you were. So just stay like that. And that's all I try to stay. I mean, if I scored a goal, I enjoy scoring the goal, but it's a goal for everybody.
Yeah.
And the only goals that are important are the goals that don't win you anything. So I love to win. Love to compete, love to share the success that was given, and also appreciative of the help that every single person gives you. And you shouldn't underestimate the importance the support can give the players, the confidence, the belief, the desire, and not necessarily just when they're winning. When they're having a bad patch as well, that's when they really need them. And I think that's when their supporters come into their own.
How was the... I was the party after that night, because I know from the stories the lads tell me, you could certainly party after winning something. What was it like after 78?
Oh, Big Hansen went to the bar to get a drink at a Canadian club, an American dry or something. And he said, came back and he went, look. I went, what? He went, they gave me a bottle. Look, I just went out here. I said, yeah, but you don't need to drink it. No, they knew how to enjoy themselves. Mind you, the boys that had been there before us, certainly they had a fair idea as well.
Yeah.
Because
do you think that's part of it?
They'd had enough of it. By the way, if you can't enjoy your success, what chance have you got?
Yeah.
You're in there every day working away to try and get success. You play the games, you get some bumps, you get some bonuses. You win something, you can't enjoy it. Oh, don't tell me it's the taking part that counts. That's only when you lose.
You can enjoy too much, Jason, though, can't you?
No. I mean, Bob Paisley had the best statement ever. Because they played in Rome, right, when the first European Cup won. And old Bob said, the last time I was in Rome, he said I was driving a tank. right? He's in the Albion, obviously. And he says, after the game, he says, I said, no, do you know what? There's no way I'm going to ever drink. He said, because I want to get drunk in the atmosphere and enjoy the moment. I never listened to that. I never adhered to that rule. That was all bull. That's that.
Nate, I think as well, you know, there's been a lot of stories about Melwood over the last couple of weeks, obviously, because it's closed and they've moved and stuff. But what people don't understand is, like, from Monday to Friday, you know, there's you know, so much hard work done on the training pitch that people don't see. There's so many miles run, so many tactics taught, you know, and everything happens there at Melwood. It's all born there. We only see the final product on a Saturday or a Wednesday. You know, the hard work is done there. And when you do get to, you know, I wasn't, you know, as lucky as Kenny to play in as many finals or to win as much, but I've, you know, tasted success in different ways. You know, for an elite sportsman, that's when you know, that's your reward. That's what you do it for, is to win, you know, for yourself, your team and the crowd. And, you know, you need to feel that success. You need to have that feeling. And I think it's vitally important, you know, that all that hard work, you know, times when you're being sick in pre-season, or, you know, you're not picked and there's tears or whatever it is, you know, when you get back in the team and you win, you know, it should be celebrated. And Kenny's right, you know, you need to feel that, because it brings you back. It you want more of it.
Mm. Oh, of course. Mm. I tell you, I said that to somebody, it might have been Robbo. I said, it's brilliant to win your first medal, but it's even better to win your second one.
It's true.
Isn't it? Yeah. Well, you've tasted it. By the way, you can't stop. It's like eating a bar of chocolate. Bar of Cadbury's, should I say. You fucking start eating it, I'll have one square, you finish it, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you just keep going and going and going. And it's, by the way, it's we're very, very fortunate in our lives to have won anything. Mm. So, but you shouldn't underestimate what you won either. But one has been your greatest dreams, really. Mm. And the fun and the enjoyment you've had in doing it is unbelievable. It's unsurpassed. The last time I felt like that was when I got married. Why are you laughing at?
Yeah, I didn't. That's what I'm laughing at.
To keep on winning, though, there needs to be that right atmosphere, I guess, in the dressing room, Kenny, and that desire to keep getting better. And it's funny you say nobody's the finished article. When you're talking about Melwood and when you were training at Melwood, and like, people would have probably looked from the outside as you at the finished article, you're a footballer of the year. What were the areas of your game even then you were thinking, I can improve on, I can get better? Were there parts of your game that throughout your career were thinking, I wish I could just do that a little bit better?
Well, you're trying to improve in everything, don't you? But where if somebody's setting up a team, he's got to identify the deficiencies in certain parts of the team, right? And complement that deficiency with something else. I couldn't defend. So there's no point in me putting me back for a corner, because there's no way I could have defended a corner. So I've got to appreciate the guys that are back there heading balls out for corners or crunching tackles or putting in on people. Because it's no matter, it wasn't me, it wasn't for me. Well, you can do it sometime, but very seldom. You ruin the day repetitively. Mm. So for me, everybody's got their own role to play, and everybody is important, because without all the components being there, you're not going to be successful. And me, the components is individual skills and how they complement each other and how they fill in a deficiency for in some other way, shape or form, but also how the so-called better player who gets all the accolades or all the reports and paper, they don't believe it. Mm. They shouldn't believe it, and you shouldn't underestimate the ones you're playing with either, because without them, you wouldn't be able to do your job.
I heard a story.
I think what Jason was saying there about the people at Liverpool, I think they love humble people. You know, I think they love the players to be humble and respecting. Jürgen has got that. I mean, they're superb, what they set up at the moment, because he's humble. Everybody at Melwood is treated equally as important. The lady that sits at the reception when you walk in is equally as important as the boys that get in the pitch and batter teams. And if there's a party going on, the whole lot from Millwood, families, the whole lot are at their parties. And you can't tell me that doesn't, it's not the only thing, but that doesn't add towards a fantastic dressing room, great team spirit, and the happier that is, the better chance you've got of being successful. It's got to be. It's got to be.
I guess that's more important than ever now, Kenny, as well, because in the 70s and 80s, there was more of a real connection probably between supporters and players, in that the money isn't in the game, the warrant is removed. Whereas now, actually, players need to be reminded. They need to be around, like, normal people to see what it means, to see what it means to the people in Melwood who are working around the club.
No, but the boys are normal people. Why are they no normal people?
True. I guess the fact that they're...
Everybody just assumes because your wage is good that you're not a normal person. Where do you think they've come from? They've only come up the same way as what everybody else is in the working class life. And I don't see... I see... I know why the players kind of mix with the punters nowadays. Because they're not allowed to. They come out, there's pictures taken, there's these mobile phones with the cameras, and they take a picture and it's all over the place. Social media destroys them. So they don't have the opportunity to be as relaxed and as inclusive with the fans as what they would probably like to be. We were lucky when we grew up, they never had that. They never had that. So I think it's the modern technology, the modern way of thinking has snookered the players or stoked the players to figure out in that capacity.
You mentioned the players you bought in that sort of 86, 87 period, and there were a couple of Irish players in there with John Aldridge, Ray Houghton are in there. You've played alongside, you've managed
A scouser and a joke.
Two Republic of Ireland legends.
One for Castlemilk in Glasgow and one for Garston.
I'm careful now. I'm not going to ask you to rank your top five Irish players, but you were there with the likes of
Mark Lawrenson for Preston.
Yes.
Mark, there was only Ronnie Whelan, Steve Staunton.
Yeah.
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 You all had Irish in you. You must have had some Irish in you.
Who?
Somewhere. You.
Nah, they never got north of the border, did they? They never went up that.
I was having
You sneaked in there and all, Trigger.
Right? You're not wrong. I found a granny, yeah. I found a granny.
At least you found somebody.
He made the most of it as well, Kenny. He made the most of it. You mentioned Ronnie Whelan. He's a player who comes up a lot when you talk to former Liverpool players, that maybe one of the more underestimated somehow of that Liverpool team. Alongside Ronnie, just how good was he?
Well, if it was underestimated, it was by other people. It wasn't by us.
It was in the dressing room.
Yeah. In the dressing room, not on the pitch. In the dressing room as well.
Yeah.
But if you look at Ronnie's record, he's got a good record of scoring goals. You know, he scored in his debut against Stoke. We won 1-0 on a Friday night. And he scored a couple at Wembley. He's been there. I mean, Tottenham, he scored two against Tottenham, didn't he? We beat them late on. One or two.
He bent one in, didn't he?
That was Man U.
Man U,
he bent it in. Yeah. No, Ronnie Whelan could play, by the way. And let me tell you, they talk about people being dirty when you could tackle. He was filthy.
Oh, really?
Oh!
Yeah.
Dearie me.
I grew up believing that Ronnie was the most cultured midfielder around. He'd leave that dirty stuff to somebody else.
No, he could do it.
He used to kick a mean opponent.
Good man. Right.
Well, he was. And it was always the side of the foot. He was always that he went in. He never went in that way. He went in that way.
And he was really versatile, wasn't he? He could play in loads of different positions.
Yeah. And it didn't matter where he played. It didn't matter where he played. The level of performance was still right up there.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.